Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi all, and welcome to another episode of the Motormouth podcast. Now today, I need you to focus because we have a man on the show with a very impressive brain and an equally impressive CV. It's Dr. Tom McCarthy. He's executive director at a company called Aspire. Now, they're the people behind A2RL. If you haven't heard of that, it's the Abu Dhabi Autonomous Racing League. Yes, autonomous, no drivers. The technology is insane, and his vision around the future of autonomous mobility is a thing to behold. I hope you enjoy the show, and if you've got any questions, feel free to get in touch through our socials or send me a voice note to ts@motormouth-media.com, and we'll be sure to respond in a future episode. But for now, let's go and meet one of the people at the beating computer heart of A2RL, Dr. Tom McCarthy. Tom, welcome to the show. Dr. Tom, I should say. What we like to do, Tom, before we get into the nitty-gritty of why you're here and talking about A2RL, I'm always intrigued to find out what's shaped our guests, what's made them the person that they are. So take us back to a young Tom before you were a doctor. What shaped you? Where did you grow up? Where was home originally?
I grew up in Cork in Ireland, very far south of Ireland, and ended up going to university quite young when I was about 17, hadn't a clue what I was going to do, and wandered in there someday and met the woman in the admissions office, said, I'd always wanted to do economics. And I said, what's that? She said, I don't know, just go down and try it out. So I walked into a lecture and it changed my life. I mean, it taught me how to think in different ways. And I followed that passion then for about 10 years. I ended up going to Canada, doing graduate work, and then ultimately becoming a university professor. Kept going at that for about 15 years. And then one day somebody asked me to do a piece of management. I had spent time in Canada and I wanted to create a graduate program in Ireland that could rival anything that could be done in North America. I did that and it was really, really successful. I attracted all the best students in Ireland to come to our course. And then the university president said, hey, I'd like you to do that job at the university level. And that led to a job as a dean of graduate studies. And then in Ireland, about 25 years ago, they decided they want to really invest in research. So they needed people to be vice presidents for research in the universities. And I ended up doing that. And then because I was an economist and not a sort of a physicist or a biologist and wasn't going to be competing for money and had more of a policy bent, I ended up being asked to do big policy roles. I became chairman of Ireland's Advisory Science Council and of the Higher Education Authority. I became a member of that. So I ended up having a huge role in forming the policy for research and development in Ireland. And then I subsequently, you know, these were not so much full-time jobs. I was became a dean of a business school, chief executive of a management institute. And then after 15 years in management, I just said, I want to go back to projects. So I set up my own consultancy, spent about 10 years doing that, and ended up coming to the UAE to do a project, and really loved the area. So I started spending about a third of my year in the broader Gulf area. And then COVID hit. And so one had to go and do nothing for a while. I ended up building gardens and things. And then it convinced me that I needed a new challenge afterwards. And then I got the opportunity to come here to work for Aspire in Abu Dhabi. And that has led me in all sorts of directions. If you'd have said to me 2 or 3 years ago, you're going to be involved in motorsport and putting AI technology into robotic cars, I'd have said, what? But I think it's been the nature of my career. Somebody once described it as peripatetic. And I thought that was an insult, but I think peripatetic means well-traveled. Ah. So my career has taken the paths that have presented themselves.
I like that. And I'm very much the same. I like to just say yes to stuff and good things happen. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're in Abu Dhabi. I used to live in Abu Dhabi. I was there for a couple of years, then moved down to Dubai, thoroughly enjoyed it. Are you enjoying life in the sunshine? It's a lovely place to be. How is it for you?
I absolutely love Abu Dhabi. The first time I came here was in 2014. And from the minute I got here, I liked the pace. I liked the people. I liked the diversity. More so than Dubai. Dubai is a beautiful place to go visit, not so much to live there. I love living in Abu Dhabi. So for the last 2.5 years I've lived here, the standard of accommodation, the quality of accommodation is really good, the quality of life. And I mean, the point that stands out is the safety. An awful lot of my female colleagues talk about it as being the safest place they've ever lived in the world. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place to work.
Yeah, it is. And you benefit from that lovely sunshine. Are you going to come back in the summer, or are you going to stick it out and cope with that ridiculous heat?
I actually, in a strange way, remember I grew up in Ireland, the south coast of Ireland. My house there is on the sea. So when it rains, it feels like the sea is washing over you. And I think I've done enough rain and cold. So when people complain here in the heat of the summer, I kind of think, no, I think I can handle this.
Oh, really?
You know, so I actually love July and August there.
Oh, it's brutal. I can't do it. I used to come back in those. It's like when you go to a shopping mall and there's no air conditioning in those underground car parks. I felt like I was going to spontaneously combust.
Well, I tell you what, Timmy, I have this thing, you know, I always wanted to be fit and do exercise, but I hated running. And then the new science has moved on that says, look, it's about high intensity interval training. It's about stressing the body. So therefore, I look at that sort of getting out in an underground park nowadays. See, that's a bit stressing of the body. You don't want to do it for an hour, but 10 minutes of it, you know, it's good for the body. Keeps it guessing.
It keeps it guessing. Maybe lose a few pounds in sweat. You know, it makes perfect sense. Right, let's turn our attention to A2RL. So where did the concept for the Abu Dhabi Autonomous Racing League originally come from? Whose brainchild is it?
Well, Tim, we work here with researchers, and one of the research centers is an autonomous robotics research center. And if I were to tell you that the first language of many of these researchers is Italian, it might give you a clue as to where motor racing came from. A lot of them had gone to school in Motor Valley, and they had motor racing in their DNA. So they were keen to get out of the lab and participate in racing. So they participated in one of the autonomous racing leagues. And then they brought back their stories. They invited leadership here to become involved. And so one thing led to another. We started thinking about, what if we were to create something here that had a truly global reach? We are here in our offices right next to the Yas Marina circuit, and we thought, gosh, you know, why can't we try to leverage off that, build a racing league from Abu Dhabi and bring the world into Abu Dhabi? I mean, you know, as we always say, 80% of the world's population is within an 8-hour flight of Abu Dhabi. And we thought, wow, this is a great way to do this, where we marry the demonstration of technology and the demonstration of pushing back those boundaries in a sporting format, which enables people to become involved in science. I mean, one of the considerations that we had was that people have become wary of science and scientific development. People have become almost scared. When I grew up, I just thought science is a good thing. It's, you know, it's elongated our lives, it's improved the quality of our lives. But I really became concerned, you know, particularly around the COVID period, when you had across the world people having doubts about the efficacy of the science. And so we thought, look, given that we're using autonomous robotics, given that we're using AI, it's important that we conduct our experiments in the public space. And what better way to do that than through a sporting platform, so that we could involve people in demonstrating what we were doing as a sporting background. So that was a big driver for us. But a lot of this goes back to what the mandate of Aspire is. And Aspire's mandate is to support the diversification and growth of the economy of Abu Dhabi, and more generally the UAE. As many people will know, the basis of wealth creation here has been resource, natural resources, particularly through oil. But what we want to do is, and what the leadership of this country wants to do, is to use those resources to bring about a transformation and diversification of the economy, so that we see more activity occurring in the food and the food tech space, in the transportation, in the healthcare space. And therefore, you're actually seeing the channeling of new technologies into the creation of businesses. So we saw this also as the basis from taking the technological developments that were occurring in the lab and bringing them into the public space to get the public involved, and also then channeling that into industrial development.
Now, the cars that you use are quite interesting. We've obviously seen things like Robo Race in the past using a certain type of car. You've chosen the Super Formula car. What's the reason or the thinking behind using that particular machine?
What's the best open wheel racer that we can get? And the Formula One cars weren't on offer to us. But we also wanted to have a one design. Because what we wanted in the first instance to test the programming and the algorithms. So Super Formula, in terms of its performance, comes in terms of performance tests, it's just after Formula One, and it also comes in that one design format. So that was the big motivating factor for us in getting the Super Formula. To get that, of course, wasn't easy. We had to form a partnership with Japan Race Promotion, given that they commissioned the design and the development of the car, and we'd also have to develop a relationship with Dallara, which we were successfully able to do. And that actually turned out to have one of those coincidences that you can't plan for. You know, the history, the UAE was formally established in 1971. And, you know, after we started talking to Dallara and JRP, it was kind of interesting to find that, you know, Dallara was established in 72 and the Japan Race Promotions was 73. So it's kind of neat that the three of us all ended up, starting off and growing up at the same time. And you could spin that as a story. Hey, we started off that way to do it, but that's not true. We really started off by what we wanted in the car in terms of its performance and in terms of its ability to be raced as a one design.
Now, you're clearly a man with an academic brain. You're a big-brained man. You've done some impressive things. You make me feel incredibly thick, as did other guests that we've had on the show. We've had people like Roddy Basso, who's, you know, got NASA science in him, and, you know, we've had some clever people. So what's, in layman's terms, because we're simple folk here, what's your specific role with the organization? What's your day-to-day?
Okay, so I mean, A2RL is one part of the organization here, and I run two big elements of this organization. One is called the Grand Challenges, or what we like to call it, the House of Grand Challenges, and the other one is I have oversight of the maturity of the R&D ecosystem here across Abu Dhabi and the UAE. So they're my two big roles. What we mean by the grand challenges are we look at things that we expect to come to maturity 10, 15 years from now. You know, we look to where technology will solve some of society's big problems. And we try to prioritize a number of those and organize them as a challenge and put them out there to the world and say, look, we want to focus on bringing the solution here sooner. We don't want to wait 10 to 15 years. We want it to happen in 5 to 10 years. So then instead of saying we're going to support doing research in a, you know, broadly based, non-directed way, we say, here's the solution we want. We're going to offer a pretty big prize. Here's the specification of what you must demonstrate. And then we launch and run the challenges. So the Abu Dhabi Autonomous Racing League, A2RL, is actually one example of those in a particular way. Next week, we have the finals of an international robotics challenge where in a GNSS-denied environment, you must use a swarm of drones, an unmanned surface vehicle, a robotic arm to go out into open sea, identify a a particular object, a ship, for inspection and intervention. And we're developing a number of other ones. We're also involved with the XPRIZE Foundation in California on something called Feed the Next Billion, where we're looking to develop fish and chicken without using animal proteins. So that's my grand challenges hat. And as I say, A2RL is a bit of that. The R&D ecosystem is something I guess I got from my early career when I was steering the development of the research and development ecosystem in Ireland. So it's the same thing. In order to bring about the transition of the economy of Abu Dhabi, we need to invest in R&D, and we need to make sure that R&D is focused on priority technologies that can underpin the priority sectors that we want to grow. So my role there is to ensure that as we increase expenditure and R&D, that the outputs and the impact in terms of the high-tech jobs and the growth of GDP across sector is optimized. So they're my two dual functions.
It's quite a big job, really, when you start thinking about it. You know, diversifying the economy in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
It's quite a responsibility. Now there are other organisations. I mentioned one of them, Robo Race. There's the India Autonomous League as well. I suppose for something like this, where your wider remit is to advance technology, it's not yes. just about the series itself. I suppose it's not a bad thing to have competitors or other organisations trying to push this technology further. Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, you know, I, as a background, I'm an economist, and I believe implicitly that competition is the best way to get things done. So, RoboRace isn't active now, but I think it was the pathfinder, and we're all sort of standing on the shoulders of the developments that they did. And in fact, I'm delighted that some of the participant teams that we have are actually graduates of RoboRace. So there's, you know, RoboRace DNA is coming true in our racing series. Indy, I think, did a fantastic job in staging series across the US and bringing it even into Europe. And I think in many ways they've taken on from RoboRace to scale up what has happened. And as I say, some of our colleagues here had participated in that. But what is super is that, you know, there we are side by side pushing each other. And I relish competition. I think it's superb. But, you know, I acknowledge too that all those have gone before, we've learned from that, we build on their shoulders, but competition for me is what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. And now we've had fairly recently on the show, we had Jack from Airspeeder on, and we were talking a lot about, you know, why are they doing it? What's the point of doing Airspeeder? And there was a lot of talk around, you know, give us 10 to 15, 20 years, we'll all be flying around in the skies, in these sort of human-sized drones, if you like. What's your take on the future of travel? I mean, you're developing autonomous AI learning cars. Do you think, putting yourself, get your crystal ball out, 20 years in the future, are we going to be flying around? Are we going to be sitting, reading the paper in the back of an autonomous car, a bit of both? Where do you see this going? Because presumably a lot of this is for the trickle down into the cars that people drive every day on the roads.
Absolutely. I think, first up, you know, while we're having the first race of the Abu Dhabi Autonomous Racing League this April, that's only one of the platforms in which we're going to be racing. We're also going to have drone racing in 2025. And we're also going to do off-road buggy racing and in the future, sea-based vehicles. So we're across the entire transportation sphere. In terms of where I'd see things, I think I've pushed back a lot against the idea of driverless cars, because I don't see that as being the way in the next 10, 15 years. Okay, I think in certain urban areas, one will see driverless taxis, okay? But I think the vast majority of us want to drive cars. So I see our big contribution here as improving the safety of driving those cars. If you think about it, you know, when I remember my dad's first car, you know, and sitting in and trying to turn the steering wheel without power assist, my goodness, you have to build muscles to do it, right? But you think of the advances there, and the cars now can do so much more. They can go so much faster. They can brake so much easier, but they are far more intelligent beings. But what hasn't caught up as much with them is the driver. So I think what the big challenge in ordinary car driving is the gap that has developed between the capability of the car and the capability of the average driver. And, you know, it's scary to see accident statistics across countries where we see increases in accidents, increases in mortality rates. And I think a lot of it comes from this gap between the capability of the car and the capability of the individual. And where you see technology being applied is into dealing with the consequence of that gap in terms of crush zones in cars, in terms of airbags. Wouldn't it be much better if we could bridge the gap? Now you could say we could go and teach everybody to become a Formula One driver, but that ain't going to happen. But I see where autonomous capabilities can actually step in here and can work side by side with the driver. So I see the cars of the future being very much like the airplanes of now, where advanced robotics capability is sitting side by side with drivers and seamlessly interacting to improve the performance. So if I'm driving down the road now and a truck track now is in front of me, I'm very likely to become part of that casualty. Whereas if, you know, if a Formula One driver was there, they would effortlessly avoid that by using their skills with the capability of the car. My dream is that our cars will be able to have that autonomous capability sitting side by side, and that I as a driver can trust it. That isn't there at the moment. We even see this with lane assist, people turn it off. And that's one of the big drivers for us in terms of playing this out in the public space so that people can develop trust. When it comes to, you know, flying around drones, I think the use cases here are probably not so much us flying in drones, but the drones doing things for us faster and safer. I give the example of matching up organ donation to those who need to donate it. How often do we hear of people needing kidney transplants and heart transplants being on standby, having to get on a plane, having to get on a helicopter to be brought to the organ? Now, I think if I suggested to a surgeon today that they take a kidney or a heart and put it in an autonomous drone and fly from A to B, they'd laugh at me. But honestly, there's the capability to use drones for those high-value autonomous drones for those high-value payloads to get things there faster and surer and safer. So I think it's use cases like this that we will see drones getting used for in the nearer future. But an awful lot of the technologies we're developing, like in the International Robotics Challenge that Aspire is doing at the moment, you say, what's the point of GNSS denied environment? Can you imagine all of these times we hear that there's an accident on the ground in a mine or something like this? And so how often do the first responders become part of the tragedy themselves? Imagine being able to put in drones that can operate in a GNSS denied environment on the ground in order to assess, bring support, bring assistance, and assess the kind of intervention that needs to come. So I think it's always fanciful to think of us all flying around in a way like the Jetsons or something that. But yeah. I think the use cases are probably going to emerge in a more stepwise day. And particularly, I really, really do push against the idea of driverless cars, because imagine I go to the airport and I announce to everybody, you've got a pilotless flight. Who wants to get on? I think you might find empty planes.
I don't want to do that. I like the idea of, you know, incremental changes, things like lane assist and, you know, the automatic braking systems that they have. I've got an e-tron and as you say, the first thing I do when I get in the car is I turn off the lane assist, because I actually find it dangerous sometimes. Indeed. And even the automatic braking thing, like if I get to a 90 degree corner and there's a hedge in front of me, it'll slam on the brakes thinking I'm going to crash into the back of a car. So it seems like there's still quite a long way to go.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
No.
There is indeed.
From a sporting perspective, though, as if we put ourselves in the purest position, I'm sure you've been positioned this question a lot. Does the lack of a driver, does it remove that kind of emotion and ability to build narratives and storylines? I mean, you look at the Drive to Survive sensation on Netflix, which is all about the personality of the driver and the teams. How do you sort of counter that? How can we keep emotion and narratives and storylines running in a series where there is no driver?
Yeah, I mean, first up, there's no way that you can get the same gladiatorial impact of somebody being in a car. And by the way, I'd never want to see it being taken out. But for us, what we have to do is work very hard at switching around the narrative. As of now, you have a driver in the car, and coming down the wires on that driver's ears is all the instructions from the backroom team with all their signs and everything. And we're kind of, I'm sure many drivers would have from time to time flung down their headsets when they got in and said, why don't you do it yourself? So we're kind of turning around and saying, okay, guys, why don't you do it? Hop in. So we're switching out the backroom team for the driver, and we're putting the driver is now is the programmer who is sitting in the pit lane. So obviously their life isn't on the line in the same way, and there's that certain sense of that drama being taken out. But so therefore, for us, it's first of all to actually explain that how we're doing the switching out, and then secondly to actually build up the story around the actual coders. I find it fascinating when I go into a garage and I see the mechanics working, then there's a whiteboard there, there's a few kids doing math on the board, and I think something cool about that. And I'd like to think that there are people who could never have imagined themselves being a driver but could become the programmer in a car like the Super Formula car. I mean, that is so it's a different sport. And obviously I think from us what we really want to push is online first. So while we'll have a local audience, but what we really want to do is develop the online capacity, develop the VR capacity, develop the gaming capacity, so that people can become immersed in this activity. So very, very different and a big challenge to us. But one of the things I want to focus on is building up the stories behind and the personalities of the coders.
Now, just focusing on the technology a little bit more, there's LiDARs, there's radars, there's AI. How does this little box where the driver usually sits, give us a quick explanation of how on earth you get a car to drive around a complicated set of corners without a driver?
Okay, so there's a physical thing that goes in there. We call it a skid or a stack that goes in and sits right. So it sits where the driver does. And right in the middle of it is a big computer. And below this computer is a whole set of actuators. So instead of the steering wheel or the brake or the accelerator, you know, we have braking and acceleration, but that's connected into this computer through a drive-by-wire system. Then on top of the computer, as you say, we have LiDAR and radar and cameras and GPS, and they're all taking in perception data. That's the eyes of the vehicle. Of course, it's taking in all of the other data as well, like tire pressure data, temperature data, engine control unit data, and it's all been fed into that computer. And obviously the first challenge is to fuse all that information into a way in which it can be coded. Now, the next thing is you've got to code it, and there are a number of modules in which you have to code this. The first thing is what we might call the local environment, that is the car as it sits on the ground, and how it interacts with that. So you have the various actuation and the signals that come from the drive-by-wire system, and that must be optimized for the actual road conditions that are there, so that obviously you can program the car to move forward, you can use the actuation in terms of turning, braking, speeding. Now what you got to do is you got to engage that with the environment, so we can actually get the car to go straight and stop. That's very easy. But now we want the car to come and take into account the actual track it's on and actually be able to negotiate around that. So therefore, you have to take the data from the LiDAR and the radar and the cameras and the GPS and be able to do that. Now, that gets you to getting a car going around the track. But the real next thing, and this is really the secret sauce of the different teams, is how do you actually optimize your racing strategy, your racing lines, which is exactly what a driver has to do. And interestingly enough, what you find is you find that those people doing the programming, the coders, their own personality will have a determination on the risk taking that they go in there. So the human element gets caught in there. So it is quite a bit of computing, as I say, that has to be done. And certainly it's something that I can't do. But it's something that these kids can really do, which is a fascinating thing to see in operation.
What's the coolest thing about your job?
I think the coolest thing is the people I get to meet. I mean, I think my job has been very varied. You know, when I was in my 20s, I thought I'd got my dream job. I was a university lecturer in economics, and I thought this is all I'm ever going to do. And here I am in my 60s, and I'm meeting kids that are teaching me new things the whole time. So I have to say, it is the people I meet and what I learn from them.
Now then, we have a final three questions, which we ask all of our guests, and they throw up a myriad of different answers. The first one for you, and this doesn't have to be motorsport related or job related, could be absolutely anything. You can treat it how you want. What's got you excited at this very moment?
Okay, well, let me see. If you were asking me this last week, I'd have said going to the ballet in Abu Dhabi. Which, by the way, was fantastic. It was the Chinese National Ballet doing Nutcracker, which was absolutely amazing. Tonight, it's going to a Pilates class in the near term. I think the broader thing is... I mentioned earlier that I have responsibility for grand challenges, and obviously A2RL is one of those. But we're currently mapping out where we're going to go over the next 3 years with this. And from a job point of view, that's really exciting, where we look at some of society's big challenges and decide what are the ones that we're going to focus on launching. So that, in a professional sense, that's the thing that's really, really exciting me at the moment.
I'm slightly concerned that you're excited about going to Pilates. I can't think of anything worse. But well done, you. Keeping yourself physically fit. Get healthy body, healthy mind. All that. Mm-hmm. I get it.
Absolutely.
What's one lesson your job has taught you that you think everyone should learn at some point in their life?
Learning how to ask questions. I think, and I know that sounds very simplistic, but I find again and again, you're in a meeting and you know, you're trying to take in what's there. And I've always admired when somebody asks a question that everybody looks up and says, wow, either that's the question I wanted to ask, or gosh, that then starts shedding light on what's happening. So it's learning to do that. And it's particularly, I mean, when you start out your career, you're learning to do it in order to do your job. When you go on, when you become a manager, a leader, you're learning how, you know, you're going to be working with people that have such skills and knowledge that you don't have. And you've got to figure out what you need to know and how, you know, therefore being able to ask the right questions and learn to do it. I find it is a really important skill, and it's an important at any point in your life. And I don't think anybody in a school ever told me that. And I figured it out. But if somebody was asking me for advice, you know, work hard at learning to ask the right questions.
Which isn't easy, is it? Because you don't want to appear like, you know, especially if you're well into your career and you're expected to know certain stuff. Sometimes it's not easy to put yourself out there in a room full of other very intelligent people and say, I don't know the answer to this, I need some help. It's a difficult skill to master that. And I think it's something that I've noticed throughout my career, that people are terrified to, especially in a group environment, aren't they, to go, hang on a minute, let me just ask a question.
Absolutely, Tim. And you know, I used to lecture first year students for years and years, and I used to say to them, guys, you know, never be afraid to ask a question, never be afraid that you sound dumb in asking a question, because I can guarantee you that when you ask it, there'll be so many people in the room relieved that you asked this question. And you're right, you get on. I mean, I went and became a CEO of a management institute in my 40s, and I'd never taken a management course in my life, right? Now, you know, I could have spent the next 8 years being kind of, you know, trying to hide my lack of knowledge. But instead, I just said straight out, this is what I know, this is what I don't know, and here's what I need to know if I'm to do my job. So there is that point about being absolutely clear cut. And if, you know, if day one you come out and ask the question, because look, I want to do this job, I need to know these things, that will be respected. And then as you get on in your career is to actually figure out, you know, if you're to make a decision, you know, I look at some of the great leaders in the world, and you know that you know, they can't be an expert in all these things, but they have to rely on the input of experts. So they make decisions because they can ask experts the right questions, so then they can make the best decisions. So in all times in your career, work at learning to ask the right question.
Have you found, being someone that's worked in North America and in Europe, do you find that has that asked that inquisitive and open question, asking questions openly, do you find that changes from country to country? Because I worked in the States a little bit, and what I found there was, you know, people seem to be more open about asking questions, celebrate success easier. You know, even like bankruptcy was like a badge of honor rather than, you know, the absolute pile on that you get about it in the UK. Have you seen people's attitudes to work in that kind of regard different as you've gone across different continents?
I think there are major differences. I mean, I think when I went to North America first, I would have found the confidence that people had sort of knocked me back. And I was thinking, wow, gosh, these people must know so much more. And then you learn that, well, you know, some people actually have a, you know, it's not something they're putting on. It's just that they're brought up to be confident. I mean, I grew up at a time in Ireland when the country was pretty poor. And I can even see now, you know, that my own kids, as they grew up, are, you know, I've got about 10 years between my eldest and youngest guy, and I can see the difference between the kind of environment they grew up in. What's very interesting about working somewhere like the UAE, however, is the fusing of cultures there, which is quite fascinating. There's so many people from so many different parts of the world, and it's an interesting fusing. And that, again, is an interesting environment in which to work as you try to understand where people are coming from. You know, you really have to get into understanding personality types, understanding how people acquire knowledge and make decisions to manage in this kind of an environment.
Now, final question for you before we let you get on with your day. What are you scared of?
Cats.
Shut up.
Serious, yeah. I don't know what it is. I the way they look at me. And the thing is, I have a German Shepherd dog, and I don't know whether he gets it from me or what. He's absolutely terrified of cats. They really make him very anxious. But I have no job where, you know, no job challenge or anything like that. But cats, I don't know. Cats and me don't get on.
That's so weird. I don't think I've ever met anyone scared of cats. I mean, it's because of an allergy or something, but, you know, that's tiny little bundles of fur.
That's the way they look at you. They just stare there at you, and you think about what they're dreaming of doing to you. I think that's the problem, you know?
Yeah, they're plotting to take over the world. I've got two.
Oh, they are.
And both mine, Bean and Phoebe, they're arrogant little bastards. And they do just look at me like, one day I will kill you while you sleep.
That's where I'm thinking.
No, I get it. I understand that concern, and you've obviously passed that on to your massive dog as well. So the two of you can go off and be fearful of cats together. But listen, thank you so much for joining us. It's fascinating hearing from you. I always love talking to people who have had interesting and varied careers and are trying to affect change in more than just the entity that they're working in this case, the Autonomous Racing League, which sounds really, really cool. I can't wait to see the cars in action. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on the Motormouth podcast.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you for your interest.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth_, Instagram at Motormouth_official, and Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can also download the Motormouth app, where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile to interact with other fans, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. We're also proud to be supporting the Brain Tumor Charity too, so make sure you check the links in the podcast description to find out how you can help cure brain tumors quicker. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth podcast.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.